Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
There is a podcast that is a world unto itself.
A podcast as boundless as space and as timeless as infinity.
It is the place between light and shadow.
Science and superstition.
You've entered the fifth dimension.
The latest series from the Consequence Podcast Network will open the door into Jordan Peele's new revival of The Twilight Zone, and it will go as far as the limits of the mind itself. Subscribe to the fifth dimension.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you beautiful people out there. I am your host, Lior Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be the Gig. It's your backstage pass to the world of live music, and each and every single week I try and bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And what that really means is digging deep into the brains of people that I find change the way that the landscape looks. That could really mean a festival founder and why they have chosen to curate the lineup that they have chosen to curate. Does that make sense? And a choreographer who's worked on an amazing stage show. We've got some insanely talented people coming up in future episodes about this exact topic. I'm smiling. Can you hear me? A comedian as well, and an actor. Really anyone obsessed with performance in the way that we are. So yeah, I'm excited about this week's chat. Before we get there, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello.
Hey, hello.
How are you?
I'm very singy. Is that a thing you can say? If you're someone who is singing a lot, are you singy?
Yeah, sure. You can embody the motion of feeling the light aura of singing around you.
And that's the verbatim definition in Merriam-Webster, right?
Yeah, we know
Merriam. And if I asked you to repeat if I asked you to repeat that, you'd just do it word for word.
Verbatim.
Yeah, of course.
Verbiage.
But I'm doing pretty good. I'm keeping super busy. We're in the heart of festival season, as they say. But when are we not, really, at this point?
Yeah.
Did you see the lineup announcement for Riot Fest? That's the most recent one that caught my eye anyways.
I am so excited by it because we missed last year.
Yes.
But this year you've got Paddy and B-52s.
Yeah, I'm just going to say
Bikini Kill.
B-52's Slayer and Descendants. It's like they just plucked it out of my brain and were like, here you go.
I know. And it's such a magical experience. And there are so many unique festivals coming up that I'm sure everyone out there has that one festival lineup that they are so excited by.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a very good point. I think all of our listeners should find us at TMBTGpod on all of our social media or at Lior Phillips on all your social media. And let us know which festival lineup they're most excited for. Which one is the one that really hits that spot in their brain that matches the one that hits mine. And when you're done doing that, You absolutely, by law.
And when you're done selling your soul to us, complete strangers speaking in your ear right now.
When you're done doing that, you by law have to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, rate and review us. You have to. It's a law. You'll go to jail if you don't. That's how it works. No.
You'll go to our jail, which is basically into our minds, like a being John Malkovich.
Oh my
God. You'll be stuck in our minds forever. And believe me, believe you me, you do not want that.
Some wacky stuff going on in there. Each and every week, we take one of those 5-star reviews and we read them out on the show. So if you want to have your name, your words out on these airwaves, go do it. This week, we've got someone by the wonderful name Fetskala. It's a strange...
Maybe it's Fatman Scoop. What's the song to that?
I don't know.
Don't you know Fatman Scoop?
I don't know Fatman Scoop, no.
Wait, what? You don't know Fatman Scoop?
No, I don't.
Can you hear my clicking while I googly googly it?
Let's Google Fatman Scoop.
He's a promoter. It's from that song when they go, Fatman Scoop, burn down to there, put your hands up.
I do not know this. I'm eagerly awaiting the answer as Lior types out on her laptop to try to find what this song is.
Wait,
that I've not heard of.
Do you know this?
I'm continuing to vamp while she finds this.
Yeah. Teen. This is my, like, when I used to club, when I was like 15 years old. We can only probably play this for 10 seconds.
Probably less than that, but we're making commentary on it, which is all that matters.
Exactly.
We're talking about how this is probably
the
person that left this review.
But you don't know that? That's like one of the... You don't know that song?
I don't know that song.
Put your hands up.
Well, I mean, it was starting to sound familiar, but I do not know the term Fat Man Scoop.
Is everybody at home eye rolling? Well, you're probably not at home. You're probably on a commute. You're also probably on the loo. But honestly, you don't know the song? Put your hands up.
It sounded familiar.
Embarrassing. It has 13,454,891 views on Utubi. And the first comment was made 6 days ago. And the song is old as shite. And they say, who's putting their hands up in 2019?
It's apparently Lior Phillips.
What? That's it. I am. My hands are up. My face is smiling.
So Fetskala, a.k.a. Fat Man Scoop, says, Lior is giving us the elusive golden backstage pass to a whirlwind tour of musical guests. I cannot wait to see how this series unfolds.
No, that's nice.
Thanks
Me too.
Those words. That's pretty great. Thank
I
you.
Also don't know.
Thank you, Fetskala.
Thank you. So let's get into this week's interview, shall we? We have the most phenomenal guest, we'll say our.
Thank you.
Regina Spektor. We at TMBTG Studios have been big fans of Regina's for very many years, as far back as 2004's Soviet Kitsch, and she's really just such an idiosyncratic voice in the world of indie music, infusing classical-esque flourishes into these really beguiling pop structures. She matches grand scope with quite delicate intimacy, I think. And it's all been utilized on soundtracks as wide-ranging as the Hamilton mixtape, which we actually talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Hey.
So you'll see that. You'll hear that. To Kubo and the Two Strings, not to mention where maybe a lot of people first heard her, which was the opening of Orange is the New Black, which maybe I think people knew her before that.
I definitely a lot of people did, but I'm sure that a lot of people got intro'd there and then dug deeper.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's really just something theatrical and surreal and yet deeply emotionally resonant about her songwriting and her voice. And now nearly two decades into a breathtaking career that spans so many different styles and sounds, she's making her debut on Broadway with a series of shows at the Landfontein Theatre beginning June 20th.
That's right around the corner, you New York people. Mm-hmm. Get out there.
So that's in...
A little more than
time.
A week, yeah.
Yeah, and I had to work that out with her. I was so thrilled to chat with Regina again. We spoke a few years back, so reconnecting on this platform was wonderful and in this environment. And we chatted about the amazing achievement of having something on stage and recreating that stage performance. And we are so excited to share a little sneak peek into her plans for the entire 5-night engagement. So you'll get to hear about that. If you don't want any spoilers, Boo-hoo, listen through, because we chat about her life and we chat about motherhood and we chat about many other things pertaining to current life, and it's wonderful and she's open, and so just take it all in and enjoy. Let us not be delayed. This is me and Regina. Bye.
Very fuzzy brain this morning or this afternoon, because I went to a very beautiful and touching event, but it was at an obscenely early hour.
Oh. Like crazy early. What did you go to? Like, what was the event?
It was so beautiful. It was the New York Women's Foundation. They do this breakfast, and a friend of ours invited us. And it was all these really amazing women being honored, and they really spanned all different kinds of, it was some of the honorees were like Cyndi Lauper and Abigail Disney, and they were, kind of like philanthropists and artists, and other people were these really amazing women. One of them was the first Asian firefighter in New York.
Oh my gosh.
Woman.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. Okay. And she actually, I was crying through most of the speeches.
I was just going to say, I'm sure that must have been so heartbreaking in the best way. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, there were women that were were overcoming so many obstacles, whether it was sexism and racism, when there were women speaking who were escaping, lifelong lives of violence. And it was just, and it was so amazing, because I really didn't know very much about this foundation at all.
Yeah.
And they had been doing this work since the 90s. Wow. When nobody really was talking about, the sort of like the inequality of the LGBT community and all this other stuff that we sort of have become really used to fighting for. And in some ways I think it's just watching so many of these things get re-attacked. It's like instead of getting better and better and better, it's like
there's
watching,
just more focus.
And also the things that, like, I've played benefit concerts for some of these organizations like Planned Parenthood and other, amazing places, and just watching what's going on, and that we're sliding back, and they're trying to dismantle even the things that have been put in place that you sort of took for granted, like Roe versus Wade and women's, reproductive rights and all these things. And it's just slipping and sliding in lots of places. And it's, I don't know how these things keep being under attack, but anyway, it's not at all what you wanted to talk about. But
oh my gosh, I'm so curious about it, because I feel like that was something that I was talking to a friend of mine about the other day. Is it because so many more people know about those issues, or those issues are at the forefront, that they are being attacked? Because I always find, like, when a minority is under the spotlight, sometimes the focus gets put on it, and then more people have an opinion. So it's like a numbers thing, right? But unfortunately now I feel so overwhelmed by it constantly, because when you think you're taking a step forward, or I'm saying we as society, I feel like there's just so much that comes from that. There's expectations as well on minorities then to perform. There's an expectation for them to have a platform and speak where they don't really need to. They don't want to be speaking about it constantly. It's like the old story of, like, if you're a woman, you're going to be talking about being a woman, and some of us just want to live. And I can expect that for people of color, people who identify as non-binary. You know, there's so much pressure now as well to talk about it. And what if you just feel too overwhelmed and you just want to be normal and live your life?
That's a really good point. I think that in some ways, you know, one of the really beautiful things that I heard, actually, the woman who's, her name was Anna, but I can't remember her last name, who's the president of this foundation, the New York Women's Foundation. She said that one of the things that people forget is that, they call what they practice radical generosity. And it's giving, it's basically the idea that the places where there are problems, usually that's the places where you could seek solutions. And a lot of the time, instead of what people like to think, which is like, how are we going to solve the problem of that marginalized groups face, or that women and minorities and people that are, you know, different to society, the majority of society face. And it's like, well, the answer is they can tell you usually,
yeah, exactly.
Some of the ways that those problems could be solved. It's like a lot of it is not them not having the chance, you know, maybe women who are suffering at the hands of violence and sexual abuse, a lot of the times they know where they need to be supported, you know, and maybe being able to be financially literate and being able to support themselves financially can help them.
Yeah, like what are the tools? Yeah,
exactly.
Like, what are the tools that they need, as opposed to why have they gotten to this traumatic point? Yeah, but that's a really preservational way to look at things as well. You need to make sure that everyone that you're listening to is being heard, but also you want to give space for that journey of theirs, because sometimes people who are feeling oppressed, or who are feeling marginalized or squashed down, which I often find is like the visual in my head when trauma happens, sometimes it's hard to articulate, of course, how you're feeling, because you've never been told that it's okay to talk about it. You don't know what the harmful effects could be from talking about it. So finding the tools to be supported from a very young age, I think, is such a good solution. And I'm sure that doing things like the New York Women's Foundation and being part of that, I'm sure, is one step further, because by celebrating those people who attend that breakfast, by celebrating them, you are also bringing awareness to all the people that help them in their journey. You know, I'm sure none of them would say, I did this all on my own, I'm here, you know, which I think is the beauty
The overwhelming narrative that sort of repeated through, no matter who it was, whether it was somebody like, you know, Abigail Disney, who is an heiress of Disney, who comes from tremendous wealth, but her personal world was really difficult to navigate, and she was in a tremendous amount of emotional pain, and you could see that she was in a lot of pain growing up. And also then, you know, somebody speaking who had come from Mexico at the age of 14 and went from an abusive household where she had been sexually molested to a abusive, violent marriage to, you know, having cancer. Those women in an optics, they seem like they come from absolutely different worlds. But in reality, so much of... there's such giant overlap, and that really a lot of solutions to things seem to come from being able to find a group of people, usually other women, who are able to sort of support them. And one of the phrases that kept being repeated in the speeches was, these are the shoulders of the women that I stand on, other women. And for some women, it was their mothers and grandmothers. And for other people, it was, you know, other victims of violence or people in this foundation. And it was this really beautiful image where so it was all about not being alone and being, and the other really beautiful thing that they were mentioning is that, you know, a lot of the time we tend to think like, oh, to be a philanthropist, you have to be a, you know, a millionaire, and you have to, or you have to have some kind of a giant platform. And it's true that, you know, I'm so lucky because I've been able to, I don't know, since the beginning of writing songs, I've been able to play concerts or give songs onto, or just do things for free for benefit concerts. And it's something that you can just give and you can donate money and you could donate time. But people really forget that so much of philanthropy, it's really just giving of yourself whatever it is that you have. It could be $1. It could be support. It could be being on the other end of a helpline when somebody needs to call. And so it was just really, really beautiful to see all these people come together, where some of them were these, you know, high-powered sort of human rights lawyers, and other people were students, and they didn't really have anything financial to give, but they were all activists.
But knowledge
in their own
way. And knowledge and action and participation is such a big part of it as well. And I think that you know, I was having this conversation with someone the other day about people getting upset when you post something on Twitter, like about elephants, or, you know, just you sharing, retweeting something about a petition. And the truth is that, yes, are you sitting on your, you know, on your ass at home doing, you know, work and messing around on social media? Sure. But are you actually doing something more than the person next to you? Probably. So anything, I definitely believe in facilitation and movement in that aspect. I definitely believe that even just the thought and educating people and talking about it is change and help. I definitely don't think that just money, you know, is the root. Otherwise we would be doomed, you know, because there's so many people who are so good. You know, good in their hearts, that they don't know what they can do. And you're right, even a dollar can go so far. And just also just a one-on-one conversation with someone to change their perspective or educate them. You know, I didn't know about the New York Women's Foundation. So, you know, it's just one conversation can spark that light, I think.
That's true, actually. And I do think that, you know, it's interesting because I have this sort of, not just me really, a lot of my friends, I talk about this a lot with other musicians and artist friends of mine, because we sort of, we kind of have it maybe a little bit extra, because we have this kind of a very complicated relationship with the internet and with interacting on social media, you know, because on the one hand, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful tool where you can really connect with so many people from so far away, and you don't have to physically, you know, go to every corner, and you could just send your songs and your, you know, your short stories, your poems, your art, anywhere. But on the other hand, it's also this kind of hypnotic sort of time sucking, and a lot of artists, you know, they have to sort of manage their own time. It's not like I get to wake up and go to the office and work and then come back and I feel like I got something done. I have to make that art myself. It's like you have to make the rails and then you have to make the train go on the rails. But if you don't make the rails, there's just nothing there. And it's so hard because, you know, we're all fighting for access to our own attention. And at the same time, there's such a demand on our attention from everything from, yes, the good causes, which are really important to spread the word about, but also just this constant stream of like information and events. And we're all sensitive, right? So we're all being thrown into this almost like, you know, Princess Bride,
yeah,
pit of despair.
You know? Yeah. It's so true. Yeah. It's hard to be protective,
you know.
But I think self-protection, you know, it's so challenging, because if you do it, as you said, even as an artist, and I love what you said about you have access, you know, we have access on our attention, but as an artist, you're almost expected not to close off, because you're already putting something out there. Why wouldn't you communicate on that platform? And I totally respect it when artists choose to stand back from that and let a team, you know, handle their social media, or, you know, just get off completely. I respect that, because there's so many dark holes that you can potentially go down. And it isn't just about not having our attention. Like, it's about giving attention to something that is filling your brain with things that can potentially unravel. You know, it's like the one
right
step goes to the next step. And it's like this horrible thing that almost, it's like a claw, you know, it's like clawing into the abyss. And I often find myself like, you know, like that funny meme where you are on Instagram and suddenly you're on like someone's random auntie's uncle's cousin's page, and you're like, how did I get here? Like, it's like one of those mazes, you know, those horrible.
It's almost like you
mazes.
Blacked out and you like woke up. It's like a dissociative. Yeah. Well, I used to have that. I had to do one of those things, you know, even though it's hard for me, because sometimes, you know, I've had such beautiful experiences of meeting really lovely people, like through, you know, social media, or even like, you know, I met Lynn Manuel Miranda on Twitter. You
wow
know, so it's like we became friends and made art together because of Twitter. So in one way, it's just like, oh, that's so great. And he's not the only one. I've met wonderful friends, you know, on social media. At the same time, for probably since last August, I, for the most part, haven't done a lot of it like myself.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to, I do it sort of
yeah
like almost like the kind of like carrier pigeon
yeah
style, where I will like take a picture of something and I will write some words and I will email it to the person
yeah
who will then put it up. It's like, it's so backwards, but I just can't, because I really would get, you know, sucked in and into these, you know, I would be like, well, I had 25 minutes to work on something, but especially, you know, being a mom, then your time is, you know,
so limited,
extra
yeah
precious, and so you're like, well, I had, you know, this 25 or 30 minutes to work on something, and I just spent 20 of it like looking at you know, oftentimes things of real quality. So I would be, you know, and I, yes, the polar bears are starving, and here I am crying for the last 10 minutes because I saw
yeah
a very disturbing photograph. I didn't plan to cry
no
just now for 10 minutes, you
yeah
know, and then it was the combination of maybe a very sensitive person,
no, but
and
it feels,
a lot of things coming at me.
But it also feels like that's what the beauty of it is that there's so much control and yet none of it, because it's controlled as in it's got an algorithm. There is an at to talk to somebody. There is a message that you need to click on. There's code tied to the computer and the system. But then what happens to that is completely out of control. What happens to your brain is completely out of control. That's why sometimes even before I'm going into the studio to do work, or I know that I'm going to be writing about something really sensitive or need some sort of privacy, I can't even go near my phone, because whether that's receiving a message from a family member far away or forgetting to, you know, a to-do list coming up on my calendar, you know, you're immediately like, almost like we've got a harness on our backs and we like yanked, you know, like, don't go down that route. You know, you've got to cry now, or you have to care. And it's really hard to operate on command. And I can imagine, especially as an artist, where you do have a family, you have friends around you, and you don't want to really split your attention to the wrong things. But so what do you think your perspective on your own work has shifted over time in terms of how you view societal, I don't want to say issues, but just the things that are happening around you? Has that really affected the way that you work as well?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to. I know that my headspace, as far as art, has gotten a lot better since I started, you know, not just having this sort of constant IV of information. A lot of the time I will miss important things that happen. A lot of the time you'll still hear it from people. Especially world events, you know. But, you know, a lot of my art, it seems to sort of, it doesn't necessarily come from how do I say this right? It's not necessarily coming from an intellectual place, mm-hmm. where I decide, oh, I'm going to write a song about this, or I'm very interested in this, and I'm going to, I sort of end up, yes, a lot of the time I'll get interested in things, and I almost feel like, this might be strange, but actually maybe you and maybe some of your listeners have this similar experience, where a lot of the time I feel like if you just sort of relax into what you're interested in, mm-hmm. and start to pursue it, it's almost like the world starts to curate a kind of masterclass for you, where all of a sudden you meet somebody who really happens to specialize in this, and then you go and you see an art exhibit about it, and then you happen to come across a book that helps connect it, or you start to see threads of it in a work of art that you hadn't noticed before, and all of a sudden you're just very much enveloped in a certain kind of vibe. And then a lot of the time whatever I start to work on, it kind of gets infused in that, but I don't really come at it from an intellectual point, so I can never say, well, this song is about this and this and this and this, or I wanted to write a song about this. But some people can, you know. Sometimes there are many people that they can really, you'd be surprised how much they can decode their own code. I can only up to a point, and then I'm sort of right there with the next person being like, I know this feels meaningful, but I can't seem to decode it. Yeah.
But I think part of what makes art and creating, or even just, you know, writing and doing your own projects, is that there's an outlet for everything. You know, there's something that you want to talk about, you create a place for that to go. And when you start thinking about things that, especially in the creative space, just like you said, it does manifest, because your heart is focused on the right thing. And unfortunately, sometimes, especially with everything going on, I can imagine for an artist maybe starting out now, God, I can't even think of it really, because where do you put your focus? What is priority? You know, I think after a few years that you've been doing this, you've been doing this for a long time. It's you know, it's become something, I'm sure, for you that you've had to nurture.
It's true. You know what you, when you say, I'm really fascinated by people that are creating art now, especially students that are just growing, because I'm really fascinated by the incubation period.
Mm.
I think that's so much. I had this chance. It was actually very inspiring. I was invited to teach sort of during an art student intensive for Juilliard.
Student. Okay.
It was very interesting, because I think I had more questions really than,
yeah.
I mean, I think I used questions as sort of a jump off point to connect with them, but really I was very interested in them navigating how to make art in this environment. I mean, they're a very unique breed of student, because, you know, to be in Juilliard, they're already basically better than most professionals.
Mm.
They're incredibly prodigious. And so much of it becomes, you know, translating very high level skills into artistry, which is actually the hardest thing, I think, of all. I think maybe sometimes it's easier to find artistry for a person who has a talent towards artistry than maybe even, it's like its own thing. You know, that's why you have, you could listen to somebody play a 3-chord song and be transported, and then you could listen to somebody play the most complicated music and not be transported. And those things cannot be figured out. They have to be sort of found, like grace or something. Like you have to just attain it, like enlightenment. But it was really interesting to talk to them and to how different they all were and how different their perspectives were on how to navigate making things in public. Because, you know, when I was in college, or when I was sort of writing songs and going to open mics on the Lower East Side, you know, I would play a new song every time I went. I was writing all the time and trying new things. It felt so protective because I had to definitely have bravery to you know, go in front of those people and face them and play something in front of them. But it wasn't a situation where I felt like this is going to live on and it's going to be on the internet.
I know,
and
forever.
It's going to be there in yeah. 7 years, you know, or in 20 years.
Mm.
It was so of the moment. And it was, and there's such beautiful, encouragement in that. Because you really can very safely kind of fall on your face and skin your knees and not have to deal with it the next morning. And they're making art, you know, basically in public. A lot of people are learning in public. A lot of people feel the need that to almost, it's almost like a backwards supply and demand. They feel like they need to create for an audience
that's
they're
desperate.
Already building
yeah.
for an audience. You know, they're trying to almost become, I don't know how to, it's a type of seeking of fame, but without even sometimes knowing why you seek it or what you should get it for. Maybe you can get it for your cool outfit. Maybe you
yeah.
can get it for a song. Maybe you can get it for your political activism, but it's like you need that light, and that you see these a lot of people sort of vying for it, and it's a very interesting thing, because you can't really blame them, because they are being shaped by the technology. And at the same time, a lot of these young musicians, dancers, they were, a lot of them had chosen to not be on social media in any kind of a marked way. And they were saying that even though even within the school they were maybe less famous or less known or less noticed, they were sort of betting on the long game. They were consciously choosing to incubate and not allow for those things to influence their mind because they wanted a pure sort of idea of art or who they are to emerge. Because and it was just like interesting because I remember being obsessed with that, where I really didn't want to. I was so sure that I didn't want to get signed and I didn't want to get anybody involved or any kind of input from, quote, you know, the music business, whoever they are, you know, until I knew who I was myself. Like, I was obsessed with that. I would say no thank you to opportunities even when I was broke, because I was just so obsessed with, you know, well, if you don't exactly know what you're doing and who you are, and these people come in, they're going to tell you who you are. They're going to steer you towards who you are. And I think in some strange way, social media is doing that to people, because it kind of corrals you whether you want it to or not. The power is strong. So if somebody plays one song on guitar and it gets very few likes, and then they do exactly a different kind of song and it gets a lot of likes, they're incentivized to start going down a direction. It's like little mice that get a treat.
Yeah, the so creative direction. Yeah, and the mortality rate is higher. So like you putting something out, can you imagine all those open mics that you went to when you were younger? Can you imagine those were immortalized on YouTube, you know, irrespective of like the quality? Can you imagine like the quality of video back then and, you know, what people are wearing?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a very dark place to think about, but it's also really wonderful to know that there are artists and students out there who are choosing to separate themselves, or at least just not wanting any sort of influence in their work, you know, because otherwise, as you said, if that one guitar song that they really like doesn't get many likes, that dictates the role or the direction that they're going to go, which is really, really tough. But I think there's definitely a healthy way, which I'm sure you found along, you know, along this whole journey. Well, it sounds like it sounds like you're aware of your own self, which I think is much more than what a lot of people have been able to do. But were you able then, when you got all those offers when you were younger, how were you able to consistently keep on track? Or did you like mess up a lot? Like, how much of, like, what have you learned from all those mess ups, if there were any?
In hindsight, it's very, you know, so much of life is really getting lucky and meeting good people along the way. So much of it is support. So it's really hard to know, you know, how much you made good choices, you know, and like how much you got just very profoundly lucky, and you know, and some in some ways almost like some of it you don't even ever get to choose, like, oh, I happen to be born into a family that really valued the arts, and you know, my parents were really cared even at their when they had really nothing to try and fill my life with beauty and the appreciation of the arts and how much time they spent with me and how many sort of great works of literature they put into my path and how much they gave as far as that, you know, you can't really choose that. And so that fills you with the strength to sort of make some other choices, to have faith in yourself in certain moments where maybe if I didn't have that, I wouldn't be able to, or I would just be happy for the attention, or I would just be you know, I may not have known the difference of what a genuine person feels like versus somebody who's just sort of putting it on, you know, and it's a lot of things like that. But it's interesting because if you just kind of keep going back to yourself, your inner self, you can't, it all makes you. It's when you kind of override your deep, profound feeling to try and fit something is when you tend to really fuck up. Like you really get off the path when you override that. Because there are so many different ways to get there. For all I know, I could have maybe said yes to an early opportunity and instead of holding my ground and waiting till I felt it was the right time, and I would have still been okay. It's just that I think that it was okay for me because I really, really profoundly like listened to sort of my inner feelings. It's funny because even now, like I'm doing these shows on Broadway.
I know. We'll get there.
The reason why it just hit me is because now, you know, a lot of the time when I talk to journalists or I try to sort of be as honest as I can, what happens is I'm at all times seeing seven different ways to the truth. And they're all, and a lot of them are paradoxical and conflicting. And so as I was telling you that how great it is that I was got to make everything in this total, you know, kind of underground way and discover music in the underground way. Well, first of all, I was being influenced. It just wasn't by likes and things like coming from the outside, but I was being influenced by people in that scene. You know, I was listening to musicians and being profoundly influenced. And sometimes I would hear one song and it would click my mind to a new channel. And then I would write from that channel for the next 6 months. And then I would discover some other thing and I would write from that channel for, you know, and so, but what's really amazing is that in working on these shows, I'm sort of taking, I thought it would be really fun to kind of just look at all the songs I've ever written, which is a lot. And I'm not actually getting to because it's almost too much. It's too many songs. But I had asked people, and this is the beauty of the internet, I asked them to kind of write in about songs that maybe are not very known, but that... The reason why I even have them is because people used to in 2001 and 2002 and 2003, they used to, before I was signed, before I was touring, they used to come and sometimes tape my shows. Like tape.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. With a tape recorder. Yeah.
With a tape recorder. And the interesting thing about that they took that kind of, I'm forever grateful to them for taking, first of all, that kind of interest. And second of all, then when, you know, a technology many years later, like they were doing that before the internet was really kind of what it is now. And then they have uploaded a lot of it to YouTube, you know. And so I actually get to remember these songs and relearn them because of them. Because really, in reality, I have no idea how they go. It's actually pretty slow going. I've been practicing and I've been trying. And my mind is so interesting because a lot of the time I'll just start writing a new song instead of wanting to learn old songs. So actually I wrote a new song and I've just finished it.
Oh, wonderful.
But, so I think I'm going to do it at the Broadway. One of the songs is going to be like a new song no one's ever heard. So I'm excited about that.
You have a name for the song yet? Have you named it?
I have. Yeah, it's called FaceTime Fairy Tale.
FaceTime fairy tale.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's so good. Oh my gosh. Talk to me a little bit about the first show that you ever performed. You obviously started much earlier. You were performing, you know, recitals as a child. But when was the time when you were performing your own songs? Do you remember that very first performance?
You know, I have a few that are kind of these like early ones.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go to it actually just closed, and I played at the very last moments of the open mic at Sidewalk Cafe.
Oh, wow.
It was the longest running open mic in New York. It had been going on for 35 years, way before I ever got there. So I was playing at open mics, but that's not considered a show at all, because you just pull out a number and you out of a hat, and then you play two songs. But when I was, I must have been 19 or 20, and I played two songs at the open mic. And then this couple approached me. They were older than me by quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these beautiful, shining faces. And it was this woman, Renata, and this man, Peter, and they were from Switzerland. And they were just so sweet about the two songs that I played. And they said, you know, we want to buy something. We want to buy a CD from you. And I didn't even have my first, I didn't even have 1111 yet,
mm-hmm.
but I had had like a, I think I had like a home burned CDR of the first maybe six songs that were going to end up on it, or maybe
mm-hmm.
even some songs that didn't end up on it. It was just demos,
yeah.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I don't have anything for you to buy, but you can have this. And they were insisting, and no, we're going to buy it. And, you know, they just insisted, and they gave me money for it. And I just, you know, and I gave them my email. And I think I still at that time had like my college email. Like it was like
yeah.
.edu, you know.
yeah.
like, okay.
At Hotmail.
You know?
No, yeah.
And,
yeah.
exactly. It was all those days
yeah.
of the spammy email.
Yeah.
And then I sort of forgot about it, you know, and I was like, that was, you know, lovely. And then, I don't know, a few weeks later, I get this email. I'm at the school library, which was the only place you could check email. And I get this email, and it's from Switzerland, and it's a woman who booked concerts.
Oh, wow.
In this small, yeah, in this like old cinema in Switzerland. And she said, you know, I got to hear your record, and I want to book you here for a show.
Oh my gosh.
And I'd never played a show in New York yet. And I was like, okay, I could do this. So she said, what is your fee? And I was like, okay, I don't have a fee. So I just like started, I was looking up, you know, what's the cheapest airline ticket I could get. And I found one for $420.
Oh my gosh.
At the time. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just tell them that my fee is $400 and
yeah.
then I'll pay the extra 20 myself. And that'll be great. So I wrote her and I said, you know, my fee is $400,
mm-hmm.
if that's okay. And then she wrote back and she said, yeah, great. So I'll be buying you your plane ticket. What
oh.
day can you, you know, okay. And I was like in such shock, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it was, and then, so I went, ended
That's
up
wonderful.
Going to Switzerland for like 2 weeks because
wow.
she had me, it was like the level of hospitality these people had was like, it was unheard of for, I think, most people, but especially for New York musicians where you really get treated like shit.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
really in those clubs. I mean, it was so horrible. Like you were always being cheated and, you know, just really treating you like you really don't matter. And then all of a sudden I'm like in Switzerland
where they had weeks.
They had like chocolate and cheese, and I'm staying at their house, and they had a, you know, they had a party for me, and Renata, who was a dancer, she like choreographed to my demos. So when I came, we did like, she could dance to six of the songs. Like, it was just unbelievable. I was like,
it's like Narnia. Oh, had a big, yeah.
It was. It's like, then they said, you know, we are having a party in your honor. And we went to this place, and there was a garden and with champagne, and there was a party, and there were posters of me in the town. And I was like, is this real? Like, is anyone going to ever believe me that this happened? So that's definitely a show that very much sticks out. And after that, I sort of started kind of braving my way into the much less appreciative world of New York City clubs.
But so tell me, what happened at the clubs? Because obviously everybody's got a different story when they first start out. You know, you're not taken, not only are you not taken seriously, but you're also, as you said, you're cheated out of it. So your artistry is put completely on the side. Money is a big thing. And obviously attendance is gigantic, and your friends can't come to every show. But what was your experience with it in the beginning?
Well, actually, so the first show in like my own show that I ever played in New York was at Sidewalk Cafe.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
it was actually really sweet. But I'm not a liar. I'm a very honest person, right? But it's one of the rare times in my life when I full on lied. I think it's the only reason why I got the show, and I'm pretty amazed at myself that I devised it. It's like in my mind it was like Ocean's 11, you know what I mean? Like I devised this devious
this
sort of like con plan, and it worked. But basically I knew that I'd gone there to play the open mic, mm-hmm. and I really wanted to play my own show. And I knew that they, you know, they could give you a show that was 30 minutes. That's what you started with, like if you got your first ever show. And so I called up. I basically heard at the open mic that the regular person who books the open mic and all the shows was going away for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And I thought, I'm going to call now that the new sort of rookie person is in,
mm-hmm.
and try to basically sneak my way into the schedule. So I called up, I was at college. I remember sitting on my bed in the dorm.
Yeah.
And just shaking, you know, like my whole body was just like, You know, be cool. You're going to have to, like, basically,
you're gonna have to
like,
lie.
You know, you're going to have to lie. So I
and
called
schmooze,
up.
Yeah.
And schmooze and lie, schmooze and lie. So I called up and I said, I had a show booked sometime this summer, and I lost my calendar. I can't remember when it is.
Oh, that's so good.
They said, "What's your name?" I said, "My name." And they said, "Oh, I don't see it.
I don't
maybe
see
they
you.
Forgot to write it down." And I said, "Yeah, maybe they forgot to write it down." So then they said, and then it was almost like, you know how you hear about those psychics that basically take everything you say, every
yes,
little clue,
and then yes.
and then they
repeat it.
So,
yeah.
So I was sort of like that, where she was like, she's like, "Well, I mean, you know, June seems really booked up, but July seems a little bit more open." I was like, "Oh yeah, now I remember. It was in
it
July."
It was in July.
You know, and like,
oh my God, you're a devil mastermind. That's amazing.
It was crazy. I don't even know. I feel like I got possessed.
Yeah,
you know,
no, it sounds like
because
that.
Because it was so much more slick than anything that I could really do. That it was almost like, I don't know, I feel like some kind of an ancient pirate. It's like inhabited my body and allowed for me to have my first ever show. But basically, and then they said, "Well, how many people can you bring?" And I was like, oh, well, it depends on different nights. And then she proceeded to volunteer. She said, well, because, you know, we don't like to book people who bring less than, you know, 35 people. And I was like, well, usually I bring about 40 people. She said, okay, great. So she actually gave me a show for like a Sunday night from like 8 to 8:30 or something like that. And then I was like, I hung up the phone, I wrote it in my calendar, and I'm like, you know, I'm like freaked out.
Yeah, because now it's happening.
I just like screamed into my pillow. And then I was like, okay, how the fuck am I going to get 40 people to come? Like, I don't, you know. So
yeah, 40 people, it's really, a lot. It's a lot to wrangle. Yeah.
So this is what I did. This was my big plan. And this is the amazing thing about my family and sort of my extended family, which are the friends of my parents and basically all the Russian Jews of the tri-state area. Were like, I was like, I basically like called every uncle and aunt and every cousin who was of age. And I was like, please, 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 you know, I'm playing my first ever show. Can you please come? It's on this Sunday. And they all showed up and the place was packed.
Oh my God. The person was probably like, yeah, of course that artist was on the calendar. Like, look at her. Look at her go.
Well, it was like, and the wonderful thing about all of them is that they love to eat and drink.
Mm,
so the cafe was just so happy. And then as soon as I was done playing, you know, the person doing sound, who was actually very, very, very sweet. And it was the sidewalk was a place where I never got treated like crap, which was very, very wonderful.
Yeah.
Many other New York places were, but sidewalk and the living room were the two nice places. But they came up and they said, so when do you want to play your next show? And I was so flattered. I thought it was all about my songs. And then I said, oh, you know, I could play in a couple of weeks again. And so they booked me again. And then, of course, as I started to go to other people's shows, I realized that nobody brings 40 people.
Yeah.
People play shows to like five people all the time.
Exactly.
And I was like, I could have just, you know, played the piano with my feet for 2 hours and they would have had me back because all the people came and drank and ate. So I had been really scared for no reason. But
I love that your family were there, because I also feel like, especially like in Jewish families, I know my family, it's like you say you're doing one thing and then everyone rocks up. Absolutely everybody.
Yes.
Because they all need to know what's going on. They need to find out all the news. They want to talk to everybody about it. And as you said, with drinking and eating, and people just enjoy themselves. And I love that you had that support in the beginning, because maybe if you went to play that show, you might have been a little bit derailed, you know, and think, oh, okay, maybe this isn't right. So I love that you had such good support at the time.
Yeah, it really does make such a difference, and that they were all, you know, and it's still like that. Like, you know, I'll play, like when I played Radio City or something, you know, it's like my dad is the mayor. Like, and, you know, everybody shows up and everybody supports. And the thing is, it's so genuine, because they were coming out to dingy bars and they were coming out at odd hours and really late nights. And now they're just like rolling up to beautiful theaters and they're still like, I don't know. It's just as genuine. And it's not like, oh, they waited till, you know.
Till you got big.
Yes. It's really, it means a lot.
I'm sure. So wait, was your first tour then, after all of that, was your first national tour opening for the Strokes? Or I mean, I've seen them a few times, and as someone who's like, I've experienced that fervor that they have across the globe. And what was it like on that tour, from going, you know, you're obviously experiencing touring within your own right, but then going to open for a band like that, how did you connect to them and the crowd that they had at the time?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's like there was no touring in my own right. I was touring New York City and I was playing cafes and bars. The biggest place up till then I played was Tonic. And it was different because it had a stage, you know what I mean? Like, but as opposed to just piano in a corner.
Yes.
So it really was, I'd never really gone anywhere except Switzerland. Yeah. But
that never beautiful, gone to the West magical Coast. Moment of Switzerland. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I've toured internationally. No, but I you know, it was basically, you know, I was, and in a lot of ways still am. I mean, me and my husband, Jack, like we're probably the biggest Strokes fans.
Oh, wow.
You could find out there. Maybe there's a couple of our own friends that we can, we all have, like, you know, our Strokes fan site, or whatever, in our house. But it's, you know, we love that band. Yeah, we love the music so much. And so I was just a huge, huge fan, and I didn't know them. And I sort of found out about them later than when they became really huge in New York.
Right.
Because I found out about them because actually through Gordon Raphael, whom I met through a man named Alan Bazzozzi, who was a drummer in New York. And he heard me playing one of these, you know, like, I don't know how to put it. Like, I would play everything. So I would play every showcase, every, you know, songs in the round, everything that would have me, I would play. So Alan heard me play and he said, "Oh, my friend Gordon would love your music and he could probably record you." And I said, "Awesome," because yeah. And so Gordon was the one who had recorded and produced Is This It and the Modern Age EP. So he was basically Strokes guy, and I'd never heard of the Strokes, even though they were huge already. And so I got the record and then I fell in love with the music and I was listening to it obsessively. So after we recorded Soviet Kitsch, sort of over a span of, you know, on and off, a few days here in New York, a few days in London, you know, kind of piecemealing it together, I kept bugging him and being like, "Please, please, 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 can you please play my music to the Strokes? Can you please, 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 please?"
Yeah.
You know, like a puppy, you know? And he was just like, all right, like, I'll get to it. Like,
shoo. Yeah.
And then, like, one day he did, you know? And they were working at that time on Room on Fire. And luckily, they were into it. So when it came time for them to do their big national tour for Room on Fire, and it was like they already had this amazing bill because it was before the Kings of Leon became really big, but they were already signed and they were on the same label. And so their tour was the Kings of Leon opening for the Strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they wanted to bring like First of Three. And they wanted to pick somebody really indie. Well, you couldn't get much more indie than me because I literally had a backpack and that's it. So when I met the guys and when they invited me to open for them, I just remember going to the, at that time, WizKid, their management had an office on the Lower East Side, and I remember walking into the office and them handing me like basically a calendar with all of the names of the cities.
Oh my gosh!
And all of the dates, and I remember thinking like, I can't afford to go on tour. You know what I mean? Like I can't. How am I going to travel?
Mm.
And they said, "Well, you know, tell us which ones you can make it to and how, you know, which ones you can get to.
Mm.
And then I came home to the Bronx because I was living, you know, with my parents at the time because I was so broke, I couldn't afford to pay rent.
Yeah.
So I was living in my old childhood bedroom and just like playing all these shows. And I was like, I was basically almost in tears. And I was like, this is so sad. Like I just got offered my dream and I can't really, you know, let me see what I can do and whose house can I sleep in and what can I, you know, how can I pull this together? And then my dad and my mom were just, I don't know, they'd had a conversation and they said, here's our credit card.
Oh my
gosh. Someday you'll pay us back.
Wow.
Just book what you need to book and go on all of the shows. And so that's how I got to see America for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my first time anywhere, really. And it was so special. They the guys, like, the other thing that was just so, so kind is they totally, like, they let me eat all their food. You know, they anytime we, you know, they always invited me out. And they always, like, it was like this unspoken thing where at the end of every meal, somebody would just pay for my food because I was sober, and they just knew it.
Wow.
And it was like this very, it was a very sort of, I don't know, it was a very sweet, welcoming and kind thing that I like always think about. I'm just like, wow, they really like took me in and
you never expect that, obviously. I mean, you never expect that to happen, especially from a band who signed and who's got this rapport and this fan base. You never expect them to act like that. But it feels like everyone around you always really believed in you just as much as you did. And I don't know if it's cause and effect, but it feels like because you were so passionate, you know, you had your $400 from the Switzerland gig and, you know, your backpack. Because you were obviously so passionate, people could feel that. And that's why, weirdly, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about support. And it's hard to support someone or something that doesn't believe in themselves, and it feels like you really did.
Also, I think I think even more than like something that I could do for myself, I think it goes towards what people can do for other people. Because you know, I think that signed bands, they can shine a light on somebody who is
absolutely
struggling, and then, you know, their crew, you know, that were with them, they didn't have to make sure that, you know, I was getting a ride to the airport or that I was, you know, or that, their sound guys were teaching me about sound. I had no idea how to do sound in places that big. I didn't even understand how to
translate,
perform. So it was, you know, it was a big learning curve, and they were all, you know, and, you know, after sound checking two bands, it's not like, you know, because whoever plays first sound checks last. So a lot of the time it was like, they need to go eat food too. They need to like get off the stage, but they would make sure that I could, you know, check my sound for a few minutes and get comfortable and not just kind of be just, you know, I didn't have my own
overlooked
crew. I didn't have a sound guy. So if their sound guy didn't do it, nobody would do it. So it was just, it was really, really, I think that it goes even more towards that very, very beginning of our conversation, which is, you know, that people can do a lot of kindness, and they can, you know, everybody has so much to give, and sometimes that giving isn't necessarily, you know, it's not money, but it could be time or attention or support or believing in somebody. And, you know, and I think that was the beautiful thing about that tour, is that even though it was definitely hard to go, you know, first in front of like just me and a keyboard before two rock bands and you know, to audiences that really were not there to hear me at all, it still felt still had such a positive feeling and effect on me, even if it was like, you know, even if it was challenging, and I had to really learn to sort of toughen up, especially with hecklers. They really taught me how to.
Really? You had hecklers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually, I think maybe on one of the first shows, I think I walked off stage just barely, and then I burst into tears and dashed to my dressing room because there are these really mean guys in the very, very front. And then, the guys were sort of giving me tips and telling me how they had dealt with hecklers, because you don't think of the Strokes having hecklers, because by the time you saw them, they didn't. But,
right.
You know, they played plenty of shows where they did, you know, until people decided that they were on board. And
What advice did they give you?
They just said, like, just give it right back to them. Just don't take their shit. Like, you have the mic. And so, you know, yeah. I mean, if anything, I almost, by the end of that tour, I toughened up almost too much. I had to then unlearn some of it because my natural state was much softer.
Yes.
But I was coming out and I was just like, fuck you and fuck you and fuck you.
Fuck everybody. Yeah. And then you like set a bottle on fire and throw it into the crowd.
Basically, yeah, as close to that as you could legally get. But, you know, I mean, and it's funny because I have that in me, you know. It's like, you can't be a New York City kid and not have that in you.
Sure, sure.
But I think that it took because I felt like I was so on the very first show, I felt like I was such a guest. You know, I felt like I was on their turf. And they were, like, really mad about those. It was these really mean kind of almost like frat boys and caps. And
yeah.
And they were saying, we should just get those guys thrown out. And then their road manager was saying, well, you can't. You know, they're huge fans of yours. And you know, you just... You know, give her some, you know, teach her how to fend for herself, but you can't throw out fans.
You can't draw out the frat boys and caps. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I was like, okay, give me the tools. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to smite them.
And you did, clearly. Did anybody after you were like, shut the fuck up? Did anybody turn around and be like, you know what? I like you, and start clapping. Like, how much support did you get after you gave them a little bit of hell?
Oh, yeah. No, people, I think that when you give yourself permission to fend for yourself, because sometimes people are on your side and they're upset that somebody is being rude also. But they kind of, you know, sort of shows are an interesting dynamic because there's security and you don't want to get thrown out yourself, because sometimes they don't care who started it, or and you don't know what kind of a person it is, so you don't really want to
kind of get into
but when a person then stands up for themselves, everybody's sort of empowered to kind of help them tip that, you know, make sure that it's like really it's good. So by kind of empowering me, they were able to sort of, I was able to then stand up for myself, and then the audience was able to kind of help me after that, because most of them were really sweet and cool, and it was just, you know, sometimes a few assholes make it feel like it's everybody, but it's
of
not.
Of course, because they're so loud and their presence is so big, because it's like hatred and negativity. But I've definitely been at shows where there's been hecklers next to us and the entire crowd, it's like a mob, like just jumps on them and gets them out, because, you know, you don't even want to, as a fan, which you are as well, you don't even want to be around that. You don't want to have that in your experience of a live show. You know, you don't really want those hecklers nearby. So I'm so glad that you learned the tools, but unfortunately you had to learn it through you know, experiencing it. It wasn't like, okay, this is my preventative tips. This is what I need. You know, you were able
That's how you learn, though. That's how you learn. And then you have to go through it.
I just want to talk about the Broadway show. I know we haven't really gotten to it, so I just wanted to talk about that. And obviously anyone who, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people listening who are excited for that show. And obviously it's such a dream gig for artists and kind of has been for generations to have your own Broadway show. But where were you when you heard about the opportunity? What was your reaction?
It's funny because every time you say Broadway show,
yes,
my mind goes, but it's not a Broadway show.
It is on Broadway.
It's on Broadway. Exactly. Okay. It's a very, very big distinction because, you know, Broadway shows like Sound of Music or Mary Poppins, which I love. Actually, this theater, the Lunt Fontaine Theater that I'm playing, it's the first place that Sound of Music ever was developed and ran. So that's really beautiful.
Oh my gosh.
It's the way that I've been describing it is sort of, it's, I'm thinking of it as concerts on Broadway.
Okay.
So they're not like, they're not an absolutely like, this is your, like, this is the show that I play at Radio City. So this is the show that I play on Broadway. Though it could be, because they basically said to me that it could be whatever I wanted it to.
Wow.
But the really wonderful thing about it is that it's kind of a hybrid. Musically, it sort of spans, let's see, how do I phrase it? So for many tours now, I've had the pleasure of playing with strings, with keyboard, additional keyboards, with drums, and then for the last tour that I did just in the U.S. was a solo tour, and I hadn't really played solo like that for a very long time. And that was really fun because I sort of began this kind of a little bit of the diving in and sort of rediscovering some of these older songs that kind of never got the chance to be, or sort of picking set lists where it was really just based on this is what I feel in this moment, and not thinking about really kind of
what should a Broadway look like.
Or even it was more like, you know, when you're playing with other musicians, they have to know what you're playing.
Yeah.
So when I was playing with my band, you know, I couldn't just start a song. Like I had, they have to be lit a certain way. Everybody kind of has to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So in this show, it's sort of a hybrid because it's going to have solo piano moments, which are sort of like the solo show where I'm going to be playing songs that many of them just haven't been played since those days of bars and cafes, and sort of create that feeling again, except instead of doing it in the corner of a bar, I'm doing it on Broadway. And then there's going to be other songs that are, you know, with the full lush sort of string and keyboards and all the, you know, kind of full orchestration sound. There's just certain things that you can do in the theater that you can't really do with a touring show.
Yes, I was going to ask you that because there's something like theater is amazing for creating a sense of like wonder and awe. You know, like when it's really good, it's magic. But like it's so different to a touring show. So what are the different things that you've been dealing with to adapt something from a touring stage to the theater stage?
One of the bigger things besides just repertoire and just having a really different sort of approach to even what music I choose is this particular theater has there's an entire giant wall of LED. So there's going to be all kinds of beautiful projection. We could do so much more with basically lights and staging than usually we get to do, because we get to really set up for five entire shows. So instead of setting up and then moving town.
That's so interesting.
So you could just do it like on a logistics level. There's just much more theater techniques than we could use. Like, there's so many things with like scrims and fog and lights and projections and other information other than kind of touring lights. But also, I have been collaborating with this really amazing dancer.
Okay.
So there is a very special... There's a very special kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but for a few songs, there's these very special collaborations with tap dance and
other
kinds of dance. So it's really, I'm very giddy about it. And it's amazing.
You should be. Yeah. It sounds also realizing something on paper versus actually bringing it to life and not having to break it down every day and then put it back up. Like, that sounds like such a special place to be as well in just in the trajectory of your career, to get to a point where you can offer something as expansive as this, because it sounds like, you know, going solo and then having a band around you and then dancers, that just sounds like the show that you would also want to see, you know. It sounds so natural. But so you mentioned Lin-Manuel Miranda earlier. Has he given you any advice about performing on a stage that has that expectation? So, you know, your crowd, of course, are not coming to think like, oh, she's got a storyline, we're going to have props and a set and things like that. But has he given you any advice in terms of performing, or did you give him advice in terms of performing?
Well, you know, but I it's funny. I probably should ask for some advice, except that I feel like it's such its own thing. Like, it's funny, even as I've been talking to people about it, people have been asking, well, who's directing it? Or do you have a director? And I was like, I am, I guess, you know? So I think it's only kind of like, it's very much my own thing. So I'm sort of navigating it very directly with people, but it is, I don't know, it's going to, I think it's going to be something that is basically the chance for me to explore my love of theater, but without sort of some of the traditional Broadway approach, because I don't even know where to get that, because I just don't come from that world. But it's just, I don't know, the word that I just keep seeing is like, it's just very magical, you know, all of the things that we're building just get me so giddy. I mean, yesterday we were rehearsing in this dance studio, and it was just me and the tap dancer, and all around us are these little rooms where people are working on Broadway shows, and it was just so fun. Like, it made me feel like I was in one of those movies, like Fame or something, or like a chorus line or something. I loved it, because it's very much like in the tradition of, I make pop music, but it's only so pop because it's like, it just has to be so me. So I think this is the thing about these five shows, is that they're going to be my version of what I see as, you know, theater songs in a theater, in a theatrical way. And how they flow into each other, what moments sort of transitions happen, or
And how the
songs
can inform
where a poem gets read or where...
Absolutely, yeah. Well, how the songs can inform what you decide to do as well, that I'm sure has been incredible. The thing that we always ask on the show is what your first ever concert was. Because obviously we chatted about the first time that you performed, but what was the first show that you ever saw live?
Oh, it was probably, I mean, it must have been something classical when I was little.
Mm.
I probably don't even remember. Maybe it was the opera or the ballet.
Yeah.
Probably all the way back in Moscow. Maybe something at the Bolshoi. It's hazy.
That's wonderful.
Because my parents used to take me to a lot of classical things when I was little.
Yeah.
So, I love that.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.